Mr. Chairman, distinguished dais guests, members of the National Press Club, ladies and gentlemen, I warmly welcome the opportunity to address such a distinguished group of journalists. As has been said, I almost didn't make it. Just last week, I was convicted in the city court of Albany, Georgia, for participating in a peaceful march protesting segregated conditions in that community. I decided on the basis of conscience not to pay the fine of $178, but to serve the jail sentence of 45 days. Just as I was about to get adjusted to my new home for 45 days, Reverend Abernathy and I were notified that some unknown donor had paid our fines and that we had to leave the jail. As the Atlanta Constitution suggested the other day, we have now reached a new landmark in race relations. We have witnessed persons being ejected from lunch counters during the sit-ins and thrown into jails during the freedom rides. But for the first time, we witness persons being kicked out of jail. Victor Hugo once said that there is nothing more powerful in all the world than an idea whose time has come. Anyone sensitive to the present moods in our nation must know that the time for racial justice has come. The issue is not whether segregation and discrimination will be eliminated, but how they will pass from the American scene. During the past decade, some intelligent leadership in the South recognized inevitability, but others vainly tried to stop the wind from blowing and the tides from flowing. The recalcitrant forces authored such concepts as nullification and interposition, along with uglier evils such as bombings, mob violence, and economic reprisals. But the idea whose time had come moved on, and over the rubble left by the violence of the mobsters, many communities resumed their normal activities and moved out on a new basis of partial integration. To be sure, the changes have been unevenly distributed, and in some communities, even a small beginning is barely perceptible. Yet enough has been accomplished to make the pattern of the future sharply clear. The illusions of the diehards have been shattered, and in most instances, they have made a hurried retreat from the reckless notions of ending public education and closing public facilities. But in the tradition of the old guard, which dies but does not surrender, a new hastily constructed roadblock has appeared in the form of planned and institutionalized tokenism. Thus, we have advanced in some areas from all-out unrestrained resistance to a sophisticated form of delay embodied in tokenism. In a sense, this is one of the most difficult problems that our movement confronts. But I'm confident that this tactic will prove to be as vain a hope as the earlier quest to utilize massive resistance to inhibit even a scintilla of change. Now, what of the future? Will it be marked by the same types of action as the past periods? This question is not easy to answer with precision. Certainly there will continue to be resistance. But in spite of this, I am convinced that the opponents of desegregation are fighting a losing battle. The old South has gone, never to return again. Many of the problems that we are confronting in the South today grow out of a futile attempt of the white South to maintain a system of human values that came into being under a feudalistic plantation system and which cannot survive in a day of democratic equalitarianism. First, if the South is to grow economically, it must continue to industrialize. We see signs of this vigorous industrialization with a concomitant urbanization throughout every southern state. With the growth of industry, the folk ways of white supremacy will gradually pass away. This growth of industry will also increase the purchasing power of the Negro. And this augmented purchasing power will result in improved medical care, greater educational opportunities, and more adequate housing. Each of these developments will result in a further weakening of segregation. In spite of screams of "Over my dead body, will any change come?" one must not overlook the changes that have come to the South as a result of federal action. There are always those who argue that legislation, court orders, and executive decrees from the federal government are ineffective because they cannot change the heart. They contend that you cannot legislate morals. Well, it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. The law may not change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. Federal court decrees have altered transportation patterns and changed educational mores. The habits, if not the hearts of people, have been and are being altered every day by federal action. These major social changes have a cumulative force conditioning other segments of life. More and more, the voice of the church is being heard. It is still true that the church is the most segregated major institution in America. As a minister of the gospel, I am ashamed to have to affirm that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, when we stand to sing "In Christ That Is No East Nor West," is the most segregated hour of America. But in spite of this appalling fact, we are beginning to shake the lethargy from our souls. Here and there, churches are courageously making attacks on segregation. As the church continues to take a forthright stand on this issue, the transition from a segregated to an integrated society will be infinitely smoother. Probably the most powerful force that is breaking down the barriers of segregation is a new determination of the Negro himself. For many years, the Negro tacitly accepted segregation. He was often the victim of stagnant passivity and deadening complacency. While there were always solo voices in the Negro community crying out against segregation, conditions of fear and apathy made it difficult to develop a mass chorus. But through the forces of history, something happened to the Negro. The social upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression, and the spread of the automobile have made it possible and necessary for the Negro to move away from his former isolation on the rural plantation. The decline of agriculture and parallel growth of industry have drawn large numbers of Negroes to urban centers and brought about a gradual improvement in their economic status. New contacts have led to a broadened outlook and new possibilities for educational advance. Once plagued with a tragic sense of inferiority, resulting from the crippling effects of slavery and segregation, the Negro has now been driven to re-evaluate himself. He has come to feel that he is somebody. And with this new sense of somebodiness and self-respect, a new Negro has emerged with a new determination to achieve freedom and human dignity, whatever the cost may be. And this is the true meaning of the struggle that is taking place in the South today. One cannot understand the Montgomery bus boycott and the sit-ins without understanding that that is a new Negro on the scene with a new sense of dignity and destiny. And thousands of Negroes have come to see that it is ultimately more honorable to suffer in dignity than accept segregation and humiliation. A special feature of our struggle is its universal quality. Every social strata is involved. Every age, children, teenagers, adults, and senior citizens. The whole nation was startled by the Montgomery bus boycott in 1956, chiefly because every Negro allied himself in the cause with firm discipline. The same universal involvement is now appearing in Albany, Georgia. Last December, more than 700 Negroes from this community willingly went to jail to create an effective protest. I shall never forget this experience, in which elderly women over 70, young teenagers, and middle-aged adults crowded the jail cells, some with professional degrees in medicine, law, and education, some simple housekeepers and laborers, others from business, all differences of age and social status, but all united around one objective. This is a powerful growing force which no society may wisely ignore. Fortunately, the Negro has been willing to grapple with a creative and powerful force in his struggle for racial justice, namely nonviolent resistance. This does not mean that a new method has come into being to serve as a substitute for litigation and legislation. Certainly, we must continue to work through the courts and legislative channels. But those who adhere to the method of nonviolent direct action recognize that legislation and court orders tend only to declare rights. They can never thoroughly deliver them. And only when the people themselves begin to act, are rights on paper given lifeblood. A catalyst is needed to breathe life experience into a judicial decision by the persistent exercise of the rights until they become usual and ordinary in human conduct. The method of nonviolent resistance is effective in that it has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience. It also makes it possible for the individual to struggle to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the most persistent philosophical debates of the centuries has been over the question of ends and means. And there have been those from Machiavelli on down who have argued that the end justifies a means. This, I feel, is one of the greatest tragedies of communism. Read Lenin as he says, lying, deceit, and violence are justifiable means to bring about the end of a classless society. And this is where nonviolence breaks with communism and any other method which contends that the end justifies the means. In a real sense, the means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And so in the long run, destructive means cannot bring about constructive ends because the end is pre-existent in the means. Nonviolent resistance also provides a creative force through which men can channelize their discontent. It does not require that they abandon their discontent. This discontent is sound and healthy, but nonviolence saves it from degenerating into morbid bitterness and hatred. Hate is always tragic. It is as injurious to the hater as it is to the hated. And psychiatrists are telling us now that many of the inner conflicts and strange things that happen in the subconscious are rooted in hate. And so they are now saying, love or perish. And this is the beauty of nonviolence. It says you can struggle without hating. You can fight war without violence. And it is my great hope that as the Negro plunges deeper into the quest for freedom, he will plunge even deeper into the philosophy of nonviolence. As a race, we must work passionately and unrelentingly for first-class citizenship, but we must never use second-class methods to gain it. As I've said so often, we must never succumb to the temptation of using violence in our struggle, for if this happens, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness, and our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. The nonviolent resistors can summarize their message in the following simple terms. We will take direct action against injustice without waiting for other agencies to act. We will not obey unjust laws or submit to unjust practices. We will do this peacefully and openly, because our aim is to persuade. We adopt the means of nonviolence because our end is a community at peace with itself. We will try to persuade with our words, but if our words fail, we will try to persuade with our acts. We will always be willing to talk and seek fair compromise, but we are ready to suffer when necessary and even risk our lives to become witnesses to the truth as we see it. This approach to the problem is not without successful precedent. We have the magnificent example of Mohandas K. Gandhi, who challenged the might of the British Empire and won independence for his people by using only the weapons of truth, non-injury, courage, and soul force. Today we have the noble example of thousands of Negro students who have nonviolently challenged the principalities of segregation. Their courageous and disciplined activities have come as a refreshing oasis in a desert sweltering with the heat of injustice. They have taken the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And I believe that one day, all of America will be proud of their achievements. Along with our continued efforts in nonviolent direct action, we are determined to extend our exercise of constitutional privileges to areas heretofore neglected, particularly in the exercise of the ballot. We are embarked upon a campaign to involve millions of Negroes in the use of the franchise. Some of our workers have already suffered violence and arrests for their efforts, but we will continue. We believe that with our intensified actions, a correspondingly expanded federal government program of vigorous law enforcement is indispensable. A number of administrative initiatives have been useful. And the present Justice Department has certainly moved with forthrightness and concern in the sensitive area of voter registration. But the coming period will undoubtedly require that the Justice Department utilize the Civil Rights Act of 1960 extensively and seek court-appointed referees in thousands of communities in which the right to vote is brutally denied to Negroes. Now, I have spent most of my time talking about the problem as it exists in the South, but I hope this is not interpreted as my feeling that the problem is merely Southern. Indeed, no section of our country can boast of clean hands in the area of brotherhood. Segregation may exist in the South in overt and glaring forms, but it exists in the North in hidden and subtle forms. Housing and employment discrimination are often as prominent in the North as they are in the South. In short, the racial issue that we confront in America is not a sectional, but a national problem. I must also clear up another impression which may have been conveyed. I have talked about the emerging new order of integration and the forces that are at work to assure its realization. From this, one may conclude that I am laboring under the impression that the problem is about solved now, and that men can sit complacently by the wayside and wait on the coming of the inevitable. Nothing could be further from the truth. Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. The Darwinian theory of evolution is valid in the biological realm, but when a Herbert Spencer seeks to apply it to the whole of society, there is very little evidence for it. Even a superficial look at history reveals that no social advance rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and persistent work of dedicated individuals. Without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of irrational emotionalism and social stagnation. To outline the problem is to chart the course of the Negro freedom movement. We have come to the day when a piece of freedom is not enough for us as human beings, nor for the nation of which we are part. We have been given pieces, but unlike bread, a slice of which does diminish hunger, a piece of liberty no longer suffices. Freedom is like life. You cannot be given life in installments. You cannot be given breath but no body, nor a heart but no blood vessels. Freedom is one thing. You have it all or you are not free. And our goal is freedom. I believe we will win it because the goal of the nation is freedom. Our destiny is bound up with the destiny of America. We built it for two centuries without wages. We made cotton king. We built our homes and homes for our masters and suffered injustice and humiliation, but out of a bottomless vitality continued to live and grow. If the inexpressible cruelties of slavery could not extinguish our existence, the opposition we now face will surely fail. We feel that we are the conscience of America. We are its troubled soul. We will continue to insist that right be done because both God's will and the heritage of our nation speak through our echoing demands. We are simply seeking to bring into full realization the American dream, a dream yet unfulfilled, a dream of equality of opportunity, of privilege and property widely distributed, a dream of a land where men no longer argue that the color of a man's skin determines the content of his character, the dream of a land where every man will respect the dignity and the worth of human personality. This is a dream, and when it is realized, the jangling discords of our nation will be transformed into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood, and men everywhere will know that America is truly the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Copies of Dr. King's speech are available in the lounge after the luncheon. I'm afraid I overlooked one of our head table guests when I was introducing him, and this is a grievous error for me, the Reverend R.P. Cahill, General Manager of the Catholic Standard. Father.